This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you're a parent, you know the rules. No peanuts in school, no cupcakes, no to most things homemade, because either your child suffers from food allergies or somebody else's does. Even if you're not a parent, you've seen the warning on just about every food container in the United States. This food was processed in a facility that also processes nuts or dairy or any other food item. And that's all because food allergies seem dramatically more prevalent than they were a generation ago. But are they really? A recent federal study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association finds that two-thirds of people who think they have a food allergy might be misdiagnosed. And yet, pediatric emergency room visits due to food allergies are also higher than ever. So what's really going on here? Do you have a food allergy? Does your child? Are allergies overhyped or just incorrectly diagnosed? If so, what should we do? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is Stephen Smith. He's health reporter for the Boston Globe and author of the article that appeared in the Globe today called When Food Hurts. Welcome to Radio Boston, Stephen.
Glad to be here, Meghna.
Also with us is Dr. Dale Umetsu. He's an allergy specialist at Children's Hospital and a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dr. Umetsu.
Thank you.
So, Stephen, let me start with you. Your article, your piece today really opened my eyes quite a bit, because I was quite surprised to find that it seems like some 30% of Americans believe they suffer from food allergy, but in reality that number might be as low as 10%. So why the discrepancy?
It really is fascinating. It also opened my eyes that so many people think they have these allergies. And I think there's really a panoply of factors at play here. Some of them are definitional. What the researchers who wrote this piece for the Journal of the American Medical Association found is that there really isn't even a uniform definition of what a food allergy is in the medical community. One of the federal agencies is actually working on crafting such a definition. And so that's intended to provide better guidelines for diagnosis. But beyond what happens in the medical office, I think all of us have gone out to eat one evening and awakened the next morning and felt poorly. And so what seems to happen is some people ascribe that to a food allergy when maybe it's some bacterium that's been lurking, or maybe it's something like a food intolerance, something like lactose intolerance, which is not a food allergy.
And Dr. Umetsu, then many of those people might end up in your office or the office of your colleagues and request a food allergy test. And what happens then?
Sure. So we do see many people like that. And if there is a good history of a reaction that occurs shortly after taking the food, for example, within the first few minutes or an hour, then we would do skin tests or a blood test. So the tests that we have now are relatively good in diagnosing what we call food allergy that can lead to a rapid and often explosive type of reaction called anaphylaxis.
Mm-hmm. Those are extreme cases of food allergies, but I understand that there are other cases where you do the skin test, for example, and it shows up as positive, but the person might not necessarily actually have a true full-blown full allergy. They might have some kind of food sensitivity. So why would a test show up as positive in that case?
Sure. I think that in a number of people, they do have what we call a false positive test. And unfortunately, our tests that we have today are not as reliable as we would like it to be. And so maybe as many as 50% of people who have a positive test may have a false positive test. And part of it is we don't fully understand the mechanisms by which these reactions occur. And some people do have antibodies against the food, but still can tolerate it.
Mm. Stephen Smith, I mean, you also raise this issue that there are other secondary levels of tests that doctors can do beyond that initial skin test. Can you take us through that? And, I mean, how often do people request these more intensive examinations of their potential allergies?
Well, what you're talking about, Meghna, is something called a food challenge. And that's sort of, if you will, a last resort test and should only be done by practitioners such as Dr. Umetsu, who have fully equipped capacity to resuscitate people, because what happens in that sort of test is the culprit agent is actually fed to the patient in some form to see, is it really the peanut that's causing the problem? Is it the strawberry? So you can imagine a scenario in which a patient is given the agent of his or her misery, and it induces the sort of reaction that Dr. Umetsu is referring to, anaphylaxis shock. And so you don't want to be having that in, say, your primary care physician's office, who may not be equipped to respond. So those sorts of tests are certainly in the smaller fraction of tests that are performed. There's also blood tests that can be done. And like the skin test, it also has the potential for false positives.
So, Stephen, here we are in this murky area now. This is really kind of the heart of what you've brought to light. And that is that there's types of tests that can be done. As Dr. Umetsu said, one of the key things to do is to also take a very full and careful history of the patient to find out how many other times some severe hives or closing of the throat or very scary reaction has happened to the food. That doesn't always happen. Doctors don't always take those extensive histories, maybe as much as they should. So we end up in a world where a third of people say that they believe they have food allergies. So what impact, you know, when that may not be true, we'll get into that a little bit more, but what impact is that having on people's lives where they're walking around thinking, I can't eat peanuts or I can't drink milk?
Well, I thought you sketched it out just supremely well in your opening when you were talking about how there are peanut-free zones, berry-free zones in schools. And it really has, in broad ways, reshaped the medical, social, even political landscape of our country. In fact, on Wednesday, the Massachusetts Public Health Council is poised to approve a regulation that will require every restaurant in the state to put on its menu an admonition to customers that will say, if you think you have an allergy, let your server know at the start of the meal. And that speaks to quite powerfully to how pervasive this has become.
Let's get a quick call in here. Radha is calling from Lexington. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna.
What's your thought today?
My child, I think, has lactose intolerance, and I've been giving him lactose-free milk. Is there any test to know if he has outgrown it, or will he outgrow it ever?
Oh, that's a great question, Dr. Umetsu. Let me turn that to you, because, I mean, we hear in some cases children do outgrow some of these intolerances, maybe even allergies. In other cases, they don't. Is there any way to be able to predict that?
Is this for the lactose?
Yes.
Intolerance? So the lactose intolerance is actually fairly common. There is a test for that called a lactose breath test. It's relatively complicated to do, but it can be done.
So there is a test that, okay, so one can go to the doctor and request a lactose breath test?
It's a fairly involved test, so it's only done in specialized centers.
Okay.
The main way to diagnose is, of course, is if you take a large quantity of milk and get the reactions about an hour, 2 or 3 hours later of flatulence or gas or bloating and diarrhea.
I suppose Radha also wanted to know if there's any possibility that her child might outgrow the lactose intolerance.
No, that's a genetic predisposition. And so the amount of lactase, the enzyme that digests lactose, is determined by your genetic background. So if you are in a family where lactose intolerance is common, you're very likely to continue to have that for the rest of your life.
Dr. Umetsu, let me ask you this question, because one thing that that Stephen's article and other coverage on this really interesting study that came out of the Journal of the American Medical Association is that allergists currently don't have, if I understand this correctly, a strict set of guidelines on how to test, like what test to do and then what determination to make and then what treatment protocol to follow. And that's part of the problem, is that doctors are treating everybody differently, so people are coming out of the office on the other end with maybe some confused notion of what's really wrong with them. So are you looking for, as the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is trying to do, sort of a set of guidelines to control the chaos around the diagnosis of food allergies?
Well, we are certainly looking forward to the guidelines that the NIH will generate. I think that the idea of food allergy is complicated by the fact that we don't know everything about it. There's clearly many questions that we don't understand. We don't know why it's increasing in prevalence. We don't know the best way to diagnose this, primarily because we don't fully understand how these reactions actually occur. So part of the problem with this whole area is that we just need more research to try to understand exactly what's going on, then we would be better, much better able to diagnose it and also to better treat it.
Stephen Smith of the Boston Globe, there's one thing that I just have to ask you, because you open your story with the very compelling story of a young boy who's allergic to a dozen, 15 different food items. And I know there are many, many parents out there who know this story very well. Like, every time their child even touches a peanut or something, let's say, they're worried that they're going to have to take them to the emergency room. Because in the midst of all this potential misdiagnosis, we're also seeing the journal Pediatrics reported last year that there's some 18% increase in emergency room visits from children who are suffering from some kind of allergy. So where does that put us in the story of our understanding of food allergies?
Well, this is also part of the black box here. There's a question, is there truly an increase in prevalence in these cases? What I find so fascinating about food allergies is that it's really of a piece with other diseases in which we're seeing supposedly significant increases. For instance, asthma. And there is this persistent question as to whether there is a true increase or is it better monitoring? Are people looking for it more? We've seen this with autism as well. And so with food allergies, you have certain specialists who are absolutely insistent that there is an increase. Anecdotally, as you point out, we all seem to be seeing more of these. And yet, the lead author of the piece that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association told me that she and her co-authors could not find what they regarded as truly persuasive increase evidence that there is an increase. And so you have people sort of all over the map about this.
Dr. Umetsu, we can't actually end this conversation without talking about some of the other theories as to how to maybe prevent food allergies from occurring in people, especially young children. I mean, there's a lot of conversation about the so-called hygiene theory, that we've just got too many disinfectants around and kids aren't encountering bugs and pathogens like they used to that would build up a strong immune system. So what do you make of that? And what would you advise people and parents to do when they do wonder and fear that their child or their relative has a food allergy in this day and age?
Yeah, I think clearly we don't know precisely why there is this increase in any of the allergic diseases, including asthma, hay fever, and food allergy. The hygiene hypothesis is one of the most studied and most widely quoted hypotheses. And I believe that it is probably correct, although we don't know for sure exactly which infectious agent actually is causing this. I think that I would advise parents not to try to get more infections, but there are some studies suggesting that probiotics may be some help in preventing some of the allergic diseases such as eczema. And so I often will tell my patients to use probiotics as a means to help prevent allergic diseases.
That's Dr. Dale Umetsu. He's an allergy specialist at the Children's Hospital in Boston. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Stephen Smith, health reporter for Boston Globe, thank you for your article today as well.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
Well, one of the great joys of summer weekends is the opportunity to put everything behind and immerse oneself in that little patch of heaven, the backyard garden. Now, as WBUR reporter Sasha Pfeiffer reports, the delights of the garden can also be part of the work week.
It's 3 p.m. on a recent work day, and Marie Dupre is at her job at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, where she's a graphic designer. But she isn't anywhere near her desk.
Well, the peas are shooting up because it's happy pea time. And they'll grab onto anything with these little tendrils. So we're just trying to steer the peas out of the way and up the back of the bed.
The bed is an organic raised vegetable bed on the lawn outside Harvard Pilgrim's headquarters in Wellesley. You may know the building. It's near the intersection of Routes 9 and 128, where tens of thousands of cars and trucks roll by each day.
Right here we've got carrots. This is kale. The red over there is beets. Those are radishes up at the front.
Harvard Pilgrim has vegetable beds at its Quincy location, too. About 70 employees volunteer to plant and weed and harvest, grabbing a few minutes to dig in the dirt at lunchtime or between meetings. Dupre says even out here at the trafficy cloverleaf of 128, she gets nicely lost in this little patch of green.
It's a different feeling than touching my keyboard all day. And it's nice to get out and see something green and growing and to battle some bugs instead of some corporate problem for a little while. It gives you perspective.
The main reason we did it was because we are totally serious about trying to figure out how to get people to be healthier before they get sick.
Harvard Pilgrim Vice President Judith Frampton says the company tries to promote healthy eating, and the garden helps do that. It's also a community service, since all the food raised is donated to local charities. And Frampton says the garden encourages camaraderie because it gets workers out of their cubicles and mingling with folks from other departments.
People are talking about stuff at work that they haven't talked about before. How do you cook quinoa? What is that? How do you wilt spinach? You know, what's the difference between chard and kale?
This is something that has a minimal cost that could have a decent benefit.
Bob Eubank is executive director of the New England Human Resources Association. It's a nonprofit group whose members include employee benefits specialists. Eubank says at a time when many employers are slashing benefits, gardens are a small perk that can boost morale and let companies trumpet corporate values like teamwork and wellness and sustainability. He also says they could be a recruiting tool. But is a garden really enough to lure somebody to a new job?
You never know. But let's put it this way. If everything were equal, why wouldn't it be? It certainly can't hurt.
And a garden doesn't make much of a dent in a company's bottom line. Harvard Pilgrim says it's spent about $10,000 so far on its gardens. That includes everything from construction costs to an order of ladybugs to fight off invading aphids. A garden could be coming to your employer, too. Harvard Pilgrim planted its gardens in part as a test run because it wants to persuade companies that offer Harvard Pilgrim health insurance to plant gardens of their own. And it hopes they'll have as much fun with their vegetable beds as Marie Dupre and Arthur Ensroff do.
We had to know, we're going to call the leaders of each group,
right.
You know, and so
we're bedheads.
We were bedheads.
You try not to say, this is my bedmate.
Yes. To the garden. Let's go to the garden.
For WBUR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
To the garden, ho, ho, ho.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.